hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Ghouls in the House. I'm Natalie Latofsky.
And I'm Arnold T. Blumberg.
And we are here with our Halloween episode.
Every year we try to do something a little bit thematic with our Halloween. We've tended to do three movies, because early on we were doing more pairs, we were doing more, we don't know, whatever. And we decided to do like trios, and then we started coming up, and this is fun. Tried to come up with some thematic things. Last year was shapes, because the shape of Halloween. And this year, it started with us a number of things. You wanted to share with me a childhood favorite.
Yes.
We both were kind of intrigued, with as we usually aren't these days, by a totally brand new recent release, and thought, hey, we'll watch something new for a change. Really new.
And then we scraped around to have a third one to fit the theme.
And then we did the best we could on that. But then, but basically what emerged was a theme. And what's cool is this year, it's the ABCs of horror. And the original thing, in a weird way, was just ABC, because that's the way we watched Casper. We watched Abigail. Oh, we need a B. And we were looking for a B. But then at the same time, we're also thinking, oh, and interestingly, they're both about kids. In a way. So let's find one. Can we find a B movie, huh, that's also got a kid or centered around children? And then the ABCs worked really nice. But then the other thing that came about that really we didn't plan was that all three of them also feature a really big gothic house and a lot of interesting set design.
Indeed.
Which totally fits within our original podcast premise.
So our ABCs for this episode are Abigail.
I'm sorry about what's going to happen to you.
The boy.
Franz is not like other children. It is very important that you follow these rules. Be good to him and he'll be good to you.
And Casper.
Who are you going to call? Someone else.
And if you would like to go into this podcast unspoiled, you should pause now, watch, you know, some of them, maybe not all of them, definitely Casper, and then come back.
And I just wanted to add one thing from last episode before we move forward, which is we did Drop Dead Gorgeous for our 50th episode. And one of the things I know I wanted to say, and I made a note here that I don't think I said, was when we were talking about the idea that Drop Dead Gorgeous was a slasher, it occurred to me how appropriate it was one of your favorite movies, because the Scream series is one of your favorite series, certainly like favorite slasher series. And it occurred to me that in a way, Drop Dead Gorgeous functions like Scream, because it really has a pair of killers. Because you've got Gladys Lehman killing everybody, but Becky definitely killed that guy that she was interested in.
She's got at least one
who
kill
went
on
for Amber.
Belt.
Yeah, and she really tips it in one scene when she's handling her gun, and it's clear that she was doing it too. So you've kind of got a pair of killers in Drop Dead Gorgeous.
And as we added it up, the body count is roughly on par with the original Halloween.
Yeah.
So, you know, slasher. Yeah.
So I thought it works really well for that kind of thing. Anyway. The ABCs of horror, and we were really excited about hitting something that then, like I said, seemed to even have a richer series of connections. All three of them also are dealing with family issues. I mean, I guess it's an inevitability as a trope, or like maybe just an easy, lazy choice, script writing wise, when you're putting children front and center in your story.
Right.
That if it's going to be tension, certainly in a horror movie, it may be that you're immediately going to go to there's some kind of family issue, there's some kind of family tension. And that is very much present in all three of these too, where the story is about some kind of relationship disruption or something
weird.
Yeah,
very much relationships between parents and children. And you kind of get a little bit of everything. You get daughter and father, you get father and son, you get son and both parents. It's sort of like a bit of a grab bag for everything.
Let's jump in and start pretty much doing these in order, I guess. And
let's go alphabetically.
And we started with Abigail, which is one of our rare occasions of watching something within the year that it was released. This is a 2024 movie. It was one of those ones that got an enormous amount of hype, very positive reaction from a lot of people. We've certainly talked in the past on the podcast, I'm sure, more than once about how both of us tend to have a reverse reaction to a lot of positive hype, because in the world of social media of the last 20, 25 years, that tends to equate with a certain degree of almost aggressive peer pressure that makes our reaction, well, now I don't want to watch that thing.
And also, and this is coming from someone who spent a lot of time working in social media myself, there is a pressure on a lot of people for engagement online. Mm. And so a lot of times, if they see that the trend seems to be towards engagement on positive reactions to something, people who want engagement will have a positive reaction to something in order to jump in on that and get all of the likes and the reshares and all of that. And sometimes they feel like it's not completely genuine. And sometimes it is. You know, sometimes something really does just hit right and everybody who's gushing over it has a great reason to gush over it. Sometimes everybody gushing over it genuinely means it and it's just not for us, which is also okay. You know, not every movie is going to be for every person.
And we certainly have also covered the fact that unlike the modern trend of what you would normally, I assume, encounter in a lot of the horror community, we tend to be very negative toward a lot of the so-called A24 era of elevated horror. Just most of that stuff doesn't work for us. And
none of them feel like movie-length movies.
No. And so, and going into Abigail, to wrap up the build-up here, there's some strikes against it for us. It's from Matt Bettinelli-Olpin, I believe is the name, and Tyler Gillett or Gillett. They are the team that comprise Radio Silence Productions and previously responsible for another big, huge horror hit in the modern era, Ready or Not, with Samara Weaving, which I think you enjoyed more than me, but ultimately I really disliked.
I enjoyed the premise of it more than the actual movie.
Yeah. And of course, like a lot of modern movies, an enormous amount of action, shaky cam, and all the kind of stuff that we just find annoying and detrimental to storytelling. And unfortunately, they are also the team that are responsible for the last two Scream movies,
which I hated.
So,
with a burning, fiery passion that I cannot fully describe through this microphone.
Yeah. It's just, there's a lot of strikes against it. And I've been reading about it, I think, more than you. I tend to read a lot more of the horror websites than
I like
you.
To go in cold.
And one of the things I'd seen for quite a while when this was in development, so it was totally, that's another thing about this, by the way, that I want to cover. This was known, if you were the type of person that read any media coverage whatsoever, and it still always astounds me, and I've talked about this before, if people that consider themselves intense fans of things, and yet never read anything of press. But then again, you yourself say you like to go in, you know, not knowing. So
yeah,
it's an approach. For me, it's always been, whether it was Starlog magazines when I was a kid in Fangoria or media or like websites today, I can't imagine not knowing something about the things that are being made and what's coming. And so like if you were reading this for a long time, you knew this is about a little girl vampire. They were saying it from the beginning, and in fact, this was part of the multi-year struggle that Universal's been having in a desperate attempt to try to create a new version of their monster universe. And every time they've tried to do it so far, it has been a horrible failure. This was part of it in that it was originally developed as basically a new imagining of Dracula's daughter, the first sequel to the original Bela Lugosi Dracula, which is itself far, far more respected and appreciated now than maybe it was decades ago as a truly progressive, LGBTQ-friendly take on a female vampire that really explores elements of her sexuality as much as they possibly could in 1936. And it's a wonderful performance by Gloria Holden. And obviously, if you're going to do a remake with a little girl, you're not doing Dracula's Daughter from 1936. So this became something very different.
It's really only Dracula's daughter in that she is someone's daughter and her father is a vampire who is not Dracula.
Well, that's the thing about it,
though. Is he meant to be Dracula?
I mean, the thing is they give a different name.
Yeah.
They don't say Dracula. But I think, both from the filmmaker's intent and also if you're a fan, the fact that he's an incredibly powerful figure in the underworld.
Right.
And supposedly like the most fearsome. I think the implication is supposed to be that this is Dracula using a different name. Like he's used many names over the years. Maybe Dracula was just one of them.
They maybe buried that in the subtext a little too deep.
Well, I think
that's... Or I was just bored by the time he showed up. In
yeah,
which
I mean,
case, that
he's
was the problem.
He's the finale. Yeah, and I mean, I think that's like the barest thread of, if this is still technically a remake of Dracula's Daughter, the idea is he's really kind of supposed to be Dracula. But it doesn't matter because it doesn't factor into the plot in any way. So that's...
Speaking of plot, here's the thing about it. On the surface, it's kind of an interesting idea. It is at the start kind of a heist movie. You've got a team who is going to kidnap this kid and ransom her. And they're a team that's never met each other before. They've been assembled for the job, you know, classic Mission Impossible kind of stuff.
And what are they were told, like, because she's known to be the daughter of someone who's like a big underworld, like mafia.
No, they didn't know that.
Oh, they didn't know that.
Okay. They didn't know anything.
By the way, folks, I did see this movie, but it's been a while.
Basically, they're the kind of people who they get a call that says, I need you to be the medical person on this team. I need you to be the driver on this team.
Oh, but we're told. I mean, what we gather is that
we know it eventually, but we're not told that at the start.
Okay.
Yeah.
I promise I saw it.
Yeah.
I mean,
the problem is
I did see it.
And I guess is what I'm getting to with plot is they don't really know what movie they're making because you've got like your team assembled for this heist kidnapping movie. And then they're supposed to wait it out in this creepy old house off the grid until, you know, the ransom gets paid from the guy who arranged the whole thing, who naturally, like, takes their cell phones because he doesn't want anybody giving away where they are. Which, to me, whenever you're in a creepy old house in the middle of nowhere and you just did a crime and someone's like, I'm going to need your phone, it's like, eh.
And that's Giancarlo Esposito.
Yeah.
Who's always great.
So it's like, okay. And then, like, the house is creepy. It's still creepy. The people are a little weird. They're kind of unlikable, maybe a little likable. House is still creepy. It just drags and drags and drags.
I will say I do remember specifically telling you I thought it was handled, if not very subtly, at least pretty decently, where they came up with a way for one character to basically say, I know who all of you are, to be able to give us character sketches of all the characters.
Sort of. Like a party trick.
Yeah, like as exposition, it was a very obvious, but I thought, okay, attempt to say, all right, we want to lay out for you who all these people are so we can set things up.
So it's like, okay, it's a heist and they're in a place and it's old and creepy and dusty and weird. And they eventually figure out that the kid is the daughter of some underworld boss. So now they're kind of freaking out for non-horror related reasons. They just were like, oh, crap.
Yeah, because the reputation of the person is... Yeah.
And, like, of course, somebody has to then have that moment where they, like, tell a story exactly like The Usual Suspects, where they, like... The part in The Usual Suspects where somebody's like, who's Kaiser Soze? And then somebody tells some legend of something he did. Or like the Ocean's 11 moment where it's like he bankrupted his brother-in-law's tractor business. Mm-hmm. Like he'll come after everyone.
Well, we did say this is basically Ready or Not
plus
mixed with Usual
Suspects.
Yeah.
So you have that moment where everyone gets an explanation of who her father is, like, ooh, oh no. But then like everything starts to go awry. Naturally, they think, oh, somebody is like a double agent in the group who's going to come after them. And no. The kid's a vampire, and it was never about kidnapping her. It was all just about bringing her people to eat and play with, because she is creepy and weird. And it's always creepy when a kid is like an undead, infinitely old monster.
We kidnapped a vampire.
Kudos to the kid.
Great job.
I mean, first of all, we got to say, no matter what else we say at this point, everybody in the cast does a great job.
Hmm.
Very often we say that in movies, even we have problems. Cast is good. Everybody shows up, do the work, and they're good. And Alicia Weir is the kid who's got to be, like, looks like a 12-year-old girl, is a centuries-old vampire, as the thing says, Abigail.
And she sells that.
And, yeah, she's awesome. And Melissa Barrera, who, of course, they obviously already like because they worked with her in the Scream movies. She's the lead. She's good. Catherine Newton's in it also. Matthew Good, by the way, shows up at the end as Christoph Lazar. Dracula. The ancient vampire and father.
Who I'm only just figuring out, apparently, is Dracula. I watched the movie, too, in case you were wondering.
Yeah, he's Dracula. Anyway, the movie spends nearly an hour before you find out there's anything supernatural going on.
Right.
It's almost exactly an hour in when you suddenly get the reveal that the kid's a vampire and that you're in a vampire movie. And this brings up another one of my all-time favorite things that I wanted to talk about, which is I love, but also find incredibly perplexing, but I love it. Movies that act as if you don't know the movie you're watching and do a major reveal of something you obviously knew from the moment you started watching it.
Yeah.
In the case of Abigail, unless you literally denied yourself everything, and I get that there are people that attempt that to a point that to me makes zero sense. Like, I understand avoiding, like, tripping over somebody saying, hey, wasn't that movie great with that guy who got shot in the head in the first 10 minutes? I get avoiding those kind of spoilers, but avoiding trailers and promotional materials meant to show you the movie you're going to want to see, I've never understood that degree of avoidance.
Not even promotional materials. We watched it on Peacock. The description of the movie we were about to watch said she was a vampire.
Yeah. And the thing is, the picture. Like, the very
clearly
often,
her as a vampire.
The thumbnail of it will be, I mean, particularly in this day and age, it's like the movies are served to you.
Right.
With this information, the poster, anyway. So what I'm always fascinated by is, even with all that, the movie acts as if you don't know what's happening for an hour. And then does a big reveal.
Where they go, ah?
And then, hey, look at that. She's a vampire. And it's like, yes, we know.
We know.
When we sat down to watch it, we knew. And I always feel like the movie, like, really? Because we spent an hour. And to me, my ideal version of this, which is still one of my all-time favorite things, so it certainly is not a detriment, but my ideal version of this is the original Planet of the Apes.
Hmm.
Which is called Planet of the Apes and was promoted as Planet of the Apes and yet spends the first 20 minutes or so acting as if you don't know where they are.
And that apes are coming.
And then showing you a gorilla on horseback. And yes, we all agree that reveal shot is one of the best shots in the movie. But also it makes no sense because you're watching Planet of the Apes. And yet the reveal is like, ah, gorilla on a horse. How about that? And I'm fascinated by that as a narrative approach. Abigail spends an hour acting as if it's not going to be a crazy vampire movie.
Right.
And in a way, while that's interesting, I will say it's also too long.
Oh, way too long.
You know, and it should have been revealed sooner.
This was barely enough premise for one episode of a TV show.
And interestingly, this will be a recurring thing because we said this about the next thing we're going to talk about too. But
yeah.
This definitely feels like a story you'd put in an episode of an anthology series like Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Dark Side, something like
Cabinet
that.
Cabinet of Curiosities.
Could easily see this working for 42, 45 minutes.
Up to an hour.
That's fine. But this is way too long.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately we still, I think, felt like it was interesting to watch, if only because the premise was interesting. The setting was great. Like,
yes.
This old, creepy, rundown house, which is clearly the house where she does all her kills, because at one point somebody falls into literally a swimming pool full of corpses. And so, I mean, she's been doing this a while. This is just her hunting ground, and yet it looks old and abandoned. It's a very interesting thing. It's also equipped with a modern surveillance and security system where they, like, shutter all the windows and things and bolt the doors so they can't get out.
You also mentioned that that was another example of how movies will always act as if until something enters the frame, you either couldn't see it or couldn't smell it, because how are they possibly keeping the odor of all that?
Right?
Yeah.
And like they're saying just things like, oh, this house is old and creepy. Look at all this dust. And yet there was an entire swimming pool full of rotting corpses.
Smells like death.
And like the person who falls in is covered in corpse goop. And then the people around her indicate that she smells like she's covered in corpse goop.
That's another thing, by the way. I love that. That's another thing, by the way, that I remember us talking about at the time, too, which is this movie also makes us uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of it, if you've seen Ready or Not, not only feels like a repeat of Ready or Not, but feels, and I think we've talked about this before too, it feels a little bit like you're watching a catalog of some one of the creators or producers' list of kinks that they wanted to see in a movie. Because both Ready or Not and this feature young women dropped into big pools of guts and blood.
Yeah, and Ready or Not, it's like goats.
And also, don't both have a lead girl getting impaled by something that then gets pulled out?
Yep.
And there's blood.
Both of them have them just absolutely covered in blood from head to toe by the end of it. Just
make the associations as you will.
Like a wet t-shirt contest of blood.
Yeah. But clearly this is something they wanted to repeat.
Yes. Yeah,
so
to a point that we were kind of uncomfortable because it felt like we were watching somebody indulge their own fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's uncomfortable to watch.
And ultimately the thing is, once the vampire thing is revealed, it becomes a chase through the house and also a bit of a power struggle. And I will give the movie a point for the fact that the real villain of the movie turns out to be a cop, who decides that this is a wonderful opportunity to gain more power and become a vampire. And he is genuinely one of the most loathsome characters I've seen in something in a while. And he's also a vampire. But that bit, once you know Abigail's a vampire, and once you know that something more is happening, there are about at least one or two too many sequences of chasing and running around and pursuit that could easily have been compressed. And there's also a pretty good final showdown where basically in a nice little reversal, Melissa Barrera's character is human and like our final girl, basically.
Right.
Has to kind of team up with Abigail to defeat the real bad vampire, who's the cop who's become a vampire. Except that even that, as nice as it was, is a reversal.
It's so long.
It goes, that dragged out fight goes on at least three times as long as it needs to.
I picked up my phone and told you, tell me when they're done fighting.
Yeah. And the thing is, I remember years ago when I still cared about every next Marvel movie that came out. And we were watching them together. And you were never as into that as I was at the time.
Right.
For the story arc that I was invested in.
I didn't have the childhood connection to
it. Yeah. And I mean, I burned out on it eventually. But before Endgame, before all that. By the time you were hitting stuff in the middle, I was starting to feel the way I never had before, the way you were, which is fight sequences would come up and we're like, can we be done with this? It's like, it's too long.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, I get it. There's a lot of work goes into this, but my God, fight sequences go on too long. It's like, I get it. Fighting. Show me a couple cool moves and then stop. And I understand if you're doing a movie like John Wick, that's different. This is all part of the storytelling. If it's a movie where that's not the driving force, a 15-minute fight is going to just make me crazy at this point. It's ridiculous.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the other, I guess, sort of my last note on it and the thing that was sort of an interesting quasi-final reveal is that the reason that this group was all assembled as the kidnap team was, again, this is what makes it like The Usual Suspects, that every person on that team had committed some other offense or crime that had robbed this syndicate of money or personnel or whatever it might be. So they were all also chosen because her father wanted to eliminate them for the headaches that they had caused his syndicate.
And isn't that Usual Suspects?
That is Usual Suspects. Yeah. They're put together as like a lineup because they all have unknowingly stolen from Kaiser Soze.
Right.
And the idea being that the only reason they're alive is they didn't know they were stealing from Kaiser Soze. And it's kind of the same idea here. It's like they committed crimes. They didn't know necessarily they were stealing from him.
We thought there were interesting things about it. We're glad we watched it the one time. Can't imagine ever revisiting it.
House is cool.
And the house is cool, and that's about it. Some of the vampire effects are kind of cool, but ultimately not. And I do remember another thing that you particularly considered a major mark against it. And when I reviewed this on Letterboxd, I gave them a point for making the cop the villain. But I took that point back again. Because the real problem with it, one of the real issues we had with it, was Melissa Barrera's character is a mother who's had issues with her relationship with her kid. And so it becomes a Ripley Newt scenario, too, where the reason they kind of team up is, although Abigail's much older, the dynamic there is like you're looking at a mother and daughter, and she winds up sort of rediscovering her motherhood through dealing with Abigail. And Abigail sort of appreciates what she does and like sends her off to find her son. So major point taken away for this, for falling back on what we've truly grown to consider one of the most irritating and like ridiculously lazy tropes for strong female characters, quote unquote, which is to make their strength inherently part of their status of motherhood.
Right.
And that apparently you can only really be a strong, independent woman if you've had a baby.
Yeah, I mean, so, it's not to say that mothers aren't strong or that you can't be strong and a mother. I think it's just the fact that plots like this really hinge on it. That is like the wellspring of the strength. And also, honestly, it's like her character, it's really difficult to figure out how to feel about her. She was in the army, she was a medic, she had an injury, got addicted to painkillers, and like to feed her addiction, started doing like surgeries for the mob. And I'm thinking, well, if you are somebody who has a kid and the motherhood is that important to you, maybe you go to a treatment center instead of becoming a mob doctor. Like, I mean,
isn't mob doctor the right choice in that scenario?
It's hard to get behind her because ultimately she is still in many ways just as flawed as the other characters in the movie. And so really the issue is that the motherhood is presented as her one redeeming feature. And that, for me, is the ultimate problem. It's not just that it's the wellspring of her strength, because that's also questionable to me, but that it's the thing that redeems her. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that is insufficient for me.
She will be good to him, won't you, Miss Evans?
Yes, I'll treat him like my own.
We had to find something that fit between Abigail and Casper, because those two just fell into our lap. We were watching both of those, and that happened. And then we realized a B. We're going to need a B.
We thought we'd narrow it down to something with a kid in it since we had two kid movies.
And I really wanted to find something that was a name because Abigail and Casper. We got close, though, because The Boy from 2016 focuses on a doll that may or may not be supernaturally alive. And the boy's name, the doll's name, is Brahms. So in a way, there still is a B name as well, because it's Abigail, Brahms, and Casper. But the title of the movie, also a B, is The Boy. And I remember this when it came out in 2016. So we're also watching something relatively recent.
Quasi-recent, yeah.
And I remember this coming out at the time because this got a little bit more of a bump, given the fact that it stars Lauren Cohen, who most people know primarily as Maggie from Walking Dead, and shockingly still there doing, I think it's Dead City. So Lauren Cohen,
she's the only American in the movie.
In The Boy, and that's kind of part of it too, because it's like her visiting a British manor.
Yeah.
Pretty nice house. I think of the three houses we're dealing with today, I will put this as the lowest on the list.
In terms of interesting,
but it's still very good. And
I think it's the least interesting because it's a house people actively live in, and yeah, it's not abandoned.
Yeah. and she's trying to escape an abusive relationship back home. And so she's come to England, and this typically bucolic area, which when it's paired with England always means instantly either satanic cult or something weird haunted. Going on, haunted.
Yeah.
And this old couple has a son they wanted her to take care of, except that she finds out the son is a doll, which they have a great many specific rules about. And then they hustle out of there and leave her alone in a big sprawling manner with the boy. And again, this was very definitely a 42, 48 minute anthology episode of like a thriller series like Alfred Hitchcock,
if or that.
Maybe Hammer, House of Horror.
I see it more as like an EC Comics like spread. It's like the length of a comic story.
And again, we're dealing full spoilers. The biggest issue right out of the gate on this one is I was incredibly disappointed as it went on and on and on, and we slowly realized nothing supernatural is going on at all.
Nothing.
This, nothing. There's no haunting. There's no supernatural power. It is all just a thriller about a pre-zombie Jason-style hermit who's been living in that house in the walls of the house and sort of pretending, making the doll do things and pretending in order to get the companionship that he's looking for. And it's just a thriller and a pretty bad one.
Yeah, it's not thrilling as far as thrillers go.
It's very dull.
I mean, it just has really long sequences where she makes herself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with a jar of peanut butter and jelly that she brought with her from America.
I know more about how the food delivery is taken care of in a remote mansion in England through this movie than I know anything about thrilling storytelling.
The plot.
I know how boxes of food are brought.
The plot can be summarized in really just a few sentences. Family has a really weird, creepy little kid. Creepy little kid probably killed a girl. And then suddenly, before the police could arrest creepy little kid, their house catches fire. Oh no. And the kid is killed and buried. Well, cut to like 20 years later, and it turns out the kid didn't die in the fire. The parents just walled him up in the house and made him his own pretty nice apartment behind the wall. And he just travels around in the walls through the house and listens through tubes. And like every so often pretends to move a doll, and his parents, desperate to not have to take care of their weird child who they somehow decided they'd rather keep living in the walls of their house than just turn over to the police, finally relieved of their burden, literally walk into the ocean with rocks in their pockets.
They fill their pockets with rocks and just walk into the sea. And I'm thinking to myself, that is as perfect a review of this film.
And eventually her abusive boyfriend figures out where she is and shows up to take her back. And the nerdy grocery delivery guy has to try to save the day.
Which I knew was going to happen only because, considering what we were talking about earlier,
yeah.
When we called up the movie on whatever platform we watched it on, I don't remember what streaming thing we brought it up, one of the pictures online had a picture of Cohen sitting across the table from somebody I didn't recognize because he wasn't one of the first characters. And I was like, oh, maybe he shows up later. It's like, oh, the abusive boyfriend. That's where he's going to be. I mean, it was inevitable the moment you heard about him that he's going to turn up before the end of the movie.
This movie also centers around motherhood in very uncomfortable ways.
Extremely.
That she was abused by her ex, that she had been pregnant. And her ex's abuse led to her losing the baby and ultimately her finding the strength to walk away after that. But the fact that she had experienced that loss makes her particularly like emotionally raw and susceptible to eventually thinking that this doll is actually alive and that she has to care for it. Like, she has been essentially abused all over again by this family and this weirdo in the wall into thinking this doll is alive right up until the very end. Like, she actually thinks the doll is going to help save her from her abusive ex and thinks maybe he does, until finally it's like, no, there's a really weird guy in the wall who's been watching you shower.
First of all, I remember how early on she seems completely broken in the experience and treating the doll like a real boy. And I thought, first of all, we were like screaming at the screen every 5 minutes. Why hasn't she left already?
Just go.
There's so many reasons, including the first meeting with the parents. It's not just red flags. It's like someone has grabbed you and is rolling you up in a big red sheet. It's time to leave. And she not only stays, but then eventually gets completely mesmerized into believing this crap. And the thing that really got me was, again, how horribly crushing it was to find out that that's the movie we were watching. Because we were theorizing stuff that would have been so much cooler. Like, one thing I thought at one point was this stuff, like, there's missing, hair missing. And I thought, oh my God, he's making a companion doll that's her. And then he's going to do like a spell and she's going to be the doll that's with him, kind of like Chucky. And it turned out he was actually making a companion doll of her, sort of.
But just for funsies.
But just for the hell of it. Yeah. And just to have in his wall holes. And that's it.
Her hair and her dress.
And we thought, oh, there's going to be some kind of like voodoo ritual or something. Or somebody's going to like put her in a doll. Or it's going to be the doll is really. And nope, nothing. Mm-mm. Literally nothing at all. And it's like a catalog of references. We thought some of the early scenes felt a bit like The Haunting with her arrival.
Yeah, and wandering through the house and looking at stuff and it being weird and creepy.
And by the time we got to, by the time we at least passed at least twice that you said she has zero sense of self-preservation.
None. Especially after she got her first pay, which was in cash, right? I guess you could say at the beginning, she's in a foreign country. She has no money. She's literally subsisting off of peanut butter and jelly she brought from home.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why the grocery delivery is happening if she's just eating jelly out of her, like, dresser drawer.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't have anything. Okay, maybe she thinks, ugh, I can tough out. I'll be in this big old house by myself with a weird doll, whatever. But after her first week, the grocery delivery guy was like, here's your food. And also, here's your first pay packet. And it's a bunch of cash in an envelope. That is when she should say, can I get a ride with you back to town?
Yeah.
You need help in the grocer? I could just stay and work. Like, I'll make deliveries for you.
And after a couple of those, too, you were saying how it was becoming very obvious that you've got elements of Black Christmas in this.
Mm-hmm.
House on Sorority Row.
Very House on Sorority Row. Just not a sorority.
And the entire function of Brahms, really, is, like I said, he's sort of a pre-zombie Jason. Sort of Baghead Jason.
He's like the second movie.
Well, Baghead. Yeah, exactly. Eventually, it gets down to what's inevitable, which is Brahms kind of sort of saving her from Cole, her abusive, her ex. But then also,
who's a Brit trying to do an American accent, by the way. Oh,
yeah. But then also,
fresh
like,
off a stint on Vikings.
But then also, that's right. I forgot about that. Then also the food delivery guy being involved. And that was another weird thing, which was after about an hour and a half of a movie, at the very least, if nothing else, and there was very little else, it was shot well enough. The entire end action sequence suddenly goes immediately full shaky cam and weird.
Just crawling through the guts of the house.
And it was so uncomfortable and impossible to look at. And then it also went on way too long. The entire sequence through the house.
They were trying to make up for a movie that had zero action in it by putting enough action in the last 10 minutes that they feel like, oh, if you were to put it in a blender and mix it up, the percentage of action to the percentage of inaction, it didn't shake out to be about normal. It's like, no, you can't just have somebody literally wandering around eating sandwiches, emptying the rat traps, like putting food in the freezer. Just doing all your regular, like, stuff. Making phone calls home repeatedly. Just stuff in a house. Like, it's not an interesting movie.
I told you I was a good dancer. Can I keep you? Casper?
Finally, in the ABCs of horror, one of the main reasons we were doing this in the first place, which is, a while ago, well, go even further back, when I was little, before I got into Marvel Comics and Spider-Man, initially through their more child-oriented title, Spidey Super Stories, and then graduated to full-on Amazing Spider-Man. I was reading Harvey comics all the time. Richie Rich was my main favorite, but Richie Rich, Casper, Wendy, Spooky, Hot Stuff, everything. And I not only was getting mine my own, but a lot of it was because I had stacks and stacks of it from my mother's comics when she was younger. So I had Caspers and Spookies and Richie Riches from the 60s, early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. Anyway, so I had a lot of that stuff to go through. And you introduced me a while back to the feature film version of Richie Rich with Macaulay Culkin, which I had somehow never seen. Certainly at that point would have been an age. It's like, I'm happy with the Richie Rich in my head.
Also a major part of my childhood.
But yeah, so there you go. And then more recently it was like, well, you haven't seen Casper either.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea until we were delving into it both before and after. I mean, obviously, I've seen a lot of other things that Christina Ricci has done. Obviously, I loved her in the Addams Family movies, and her Wednesday to me is still like, that's the iconic one.
The best.
That's it. But I hadn't seen Casper. And again, yeah, there's the Harvey connection, but for me, my Casper's fine. And I remember reading about it at the time, but it didn't grab me in any way. And my experience seeing Casper with you for my first time was strange. It's a strange movie.
It was a little strange for me, too, because I have, and this is how it is for a lot of people, right? Like, you have nostalgia wrapped up in the memory of the feeling of something.
Sure.
And that still hasn't changed for me with this. I don't, like, there are some things you watch as an adult and you think, like, ooh, that was problematic or whatever.
And what I was going to say, too, is I didn't realize until looking into it just what a landmark this is for a particular age range that, that's more your perspective. Yeah.
There are a lot of women who are my age whose idea of romance was probably shaped by young Christina Ricci's relationship with a strange ghost boy who somehow, like, maneuvered her into his life on purpose. Which, when you put it that way, I was like, I don't know. But really, the only thing anybody ever remembers is, like, have Casper getting to have just a little treat for being so good, and he gets to be Devon Sawa for the length of about half a song and dance with Christina Ricci and, like, give her a little smooch, just a little chaste smooch. And also remembering when he's still a ghost, like, whispering, can I keep you, to her while she's sleeping, which as an adult, you look at it and think, I don't know.
That can I keep you thing was one of the things that I thought was really creepy.
It's like, it's not as creepy if he just wants companionship and friendship and sees her in the same way that people might see, like, a puppy. Which, like, you don't know ghosts are, but it becomes very clear that he has, like, a romantic interest in her, and then it's weirder that he's watching her sleep and whispering in her ear.
Yes. And the thing is, they have Devon Sawa's incarnation of the living Casper at the end repeat the can I keep you to sort of tip his hat like it's me.
Mm-hmm.
But what it says to me is, now it just feels like, well, now that I'm corporeal, you're not getting out of this house. It's disturbing. And
he's only corporeal for like a minute and a half, though.
I know. He doesn't get to keep that power.
Judging otherwise. Amy lets him be corporeal for like a minute.
But it was disturbing. But also, I have to say, I also thought there was a lot about it that was pleasant and cute. And yeah. I totally get why this movie is a thing. If I had been at the right age that time, I very well might remember this one, like I remember a lot of stuff that I saw in the early 80s. But as an adult seeing her the first time, I totally see the parts that are fun. And again, as we've been talking, house is cool.
Very cool.
The set design in this movie is extraordinary, including the whole basement laboratory area with the big machine and all that. Fantastic design. Very Addams Family-esque sequence with her riding the railway chair kind of thing. Feels very much like the Addams Family Mansion. That's all cool. But again, mixed with the fact that to me, the central, very deliberately intended romantic interest he has for her and the fact that they're both children and that also, regardless of what age Casper was supposed to be, the nature of the Casper character, who is pretty faithfully recreated in CGI from the comics.
Better CGI than most movies today use, by the way.
Looks far, far younger.
He looks like 8 years old.
He looks like a little, yeah, and it just doesn't work. At least to me, it doesn't. I think it's entirely not intended, obviously. And if you're a kid, you probably see it more purely, which I'm sure you and a lot of other people did and thought it was sweet. But when you see it from this perspective, I think this feels really wrong on a lot of levels. And not least the fact that I remember having grown up reading the comics, this movie leans completely into trying to explain how he died.
And his father went mad trying to bring him back to life.
His father went insane trying to bring him back. And then we find out he was right, that his machine works. And none of that is dealt with. That his father was correct all that time. And the thing about him starving to death slowly in the cold was like...
Oh, no. It's not even that. It's worse than that.
It's worse than
that? It's that his father bought him a sled and he was sledding and having so much fun. And then his dad said, come inside, Casper. It's getting dark. And Casper was like, I don't want to come inside. I'm having too much fun on my sled. And then he caught pneumonia and he died. Because he wouldn't stop sledding after dark. I thought they were going to have him crash into a tree or something. It's like what I vaguely remembered. I knew it was sledding. And then I was like, no, he just got the sniffles because he was having too much fun in the snow.
And I was reading a lot about it. And the thing is, contemporary with the release of the movie in 95, it was one of the things that people apparently did have a lot of criticism about, which is that the movie was a strange mix of tones.
Yeah.
It's like they weren't sure whether they were making a movie for children or trying to make a movie for people that grew up with the Casper character, which is not the sort of audience I feel like they go for that audience a lot more today than they would then, that kind of thinking.
There's a lot of slapstick in it.
It's got like Home Alone style stuff, but then it has really, really dark subject matter. The Bill Pullman character, her father, is unhealthily obsessed with trying to reconnect with his dead wife and can't get closure without it. And
he's like a ghost psychiatrist.
Yeah. And the movie gives him that closure. And like the mother comes back, but then like doesn't talk to her.
Nope. She doesn't see her.
And talks to him and tries to give him some understanding. The whole manifestation of the mother at the end is weird. I mean, there's just so much in this movie. Oh, yeah. And I totally am like skipping over Kathy Moriarty and Eric Idle as comic criminals. Kind of character pair, by the way, I thoroughly despise. It's interesting. We've covered like a trope in movies that I really kind of like in a weird way, that thing of movies pretending you don't know that thing. But here's something I hate is I hate the comedy crime duo. I hate that. Especially when they're a married couple. Because then there's also this thing of they have to be bickering with each other all the time.
I don't think they're married. I think he's just her lawyer.
No, he's the lawyer. Yeah. But they function that way.
They do.
Yeah. I mean, they function like a bickering couple. And they literally kill her off. And she wants to, because like part of the plot at one point becomes about being like a ghost.
She wants to get into a safe in the basement to get to the treasure. Which is exactly beat for beat like what they do in Richie Rich.
And also, again, Adam's Family with the same pair, with Dan Hedaya and I can't remember her name now, as the pair trying to get into their treasure. But it's the same plot. And then the other thing that's weird about it is all the weird SNL-adjacent cameos.
Mm-hmm.
And weird cameos of actors. There's an unfortunate appearance for several seconds of Mel Gibson, but what can you do? Rodney Dangerfield for some reason. But what really got me was the movie opened with them trying to get the house exorcised, and Dan Aykroyd shows up for 2 seconds as Ray in full Ghostbusters gear.
Got the whole outfit on.
So that means it counts.
Yeah.
And I've subsequently found out people do say Casper has to count. And of course it works because they're ghosts, so that's fine. So it counts. So there's one appearance as Ray with a mustache. But then, weirdly, there's an extended cameo by Father Guido Sarducci, Don DeVello, comic actor Don DeVello, whose main claim to fame was appearing many times in the classic era of Saturday Night Live as his character Father Guido Sarducci, who he plays in this. And I remember explaining that to you because you didn't know who he was. Yeah. And I'm thinking, who is this movie for that Father Guido Sarducci is getting his own scene in the beginning of Casper? And I thought, definitely not kids.
Well, also, the other ghosts are definitely not for kids.
Yeah.
They're, like, at all.
They're very, I mean, the ghostly trio are usually a problem, from what I remember in the comics.
But they're really, like, a problem where they can physically hurt people.
Yeah, and they seem like they're prone to murder.
There's and drunk.
There's also a lot of inconsistency in the movie that bothered me. Like, I don't care how comical you do, and we've talked about this before. I don't care how comical or crazy your thing is. It needs internal logic
right.
to work. And there's a lot of inconsistency in the way the ghost stuff works, including the fact that at one point, I think it's Pullman, defeats the ghostly trio with a vacuum cleaner. And I'm thinking, how the hell's the vacuum cleaner stopping them? But Ray Stantz, with his ghost traps and everything, apparently couldn't do anything to them.
It doesn't make sense.
That doesn't make any sense, because also, if this is really the Ghostbusters universe, that technology works.
It's also like a weird riff on Cinderella, because they definitely treat Casper like Cinderella, just like berating him constantly and making him cook and clean. And by cook, I mean, make a bunch of food that literally just goes right through them onto the floor, and then they make Casper clean it up.
And also, this is keeping with the long-running late 80s, early 90s obsession with doing Rube Goldberg breakfast-making devices.
Yeah.
I don't know what, for some reason, there must be somebody common to all these things who is like, I want a machine that makes breakfast.
Yeah, because it's in Pee-wee as well.
It's in Pee-wee. It's in Back to the Future 3. It's here. It just keeps coming up again and again. Rube Goldberg breakfast making devices.
There's just something inherently fun about watching little spindly robot arms crack an egg.
But the problem is, it also fits into another of our tropes we hate, which is food in movies that doesn't get eaten.
So much food. It looks great. Also, where did Casper learn to cook? Because he can definitely cook. It looks good. He makes good pancakes.
We talked again, also, so many connections in this. It's also very Beetlejuice-like, in addition to being obviously Adam's family adjacent. Mm-hmm. But of course, she brings a bit of that. Although not at all in performance. Again, she's a completely like normal character in this, and drastically different from her Wednesday performance.
In a sense, the through line to it is she has a tendency to play characters of children who are preternaturally like adults.
Mm.
And like, she's had to take care of her father because he is completely adrift and thinks that he's offering therapy to ghosts, and they move from town to town, and she basically kind of has to be the parent. I mean, and she's kind of like a little adult in Adam's Family. We recently watched Now and Then, where also yeah. she plays a character whose mother died and has to help take care of the family. And also is sharing a weirdly awkward preteen kiss with Devon Sawa. So that's a through line for her life.
That's right. Yeah.
So, I mean, she does play a slightly more adult kid, but she's definitely a kid.
And in addition, as far as references, a lot of Pullman's work with the ghostly trio feels very Roger Rabbit-like in the way they handle it. The movie itself is also, like, among other things we've just mentioned, it's also Pinocchio in a way, with him becoming a real boy, if only for, you know, a little ridiculously, it seems, unjust short time. I love this kind of universe, too, with not only the ghost rules are inconsistent, but a universe where there's a power that's enabled to give him some kind of reward, but only for a couple hours, because then he's got to go back to being dead, or that allows the mother-wife to return. And by the way, theoretically, should change that universe forever, because there's now absolute proof of an afterlife, and they found out that that guy literally created a machine that conquered death. And this should be news in that world, I think.
And they also make a point of saying that ghosts exist because people have unfinished business.
Right.
That they haven't taken care of, which is how they defeat the crazy lady who turns herself into a ghost on purpose to try to steal something from a safe. because they kind of taunt her to be like, you know, you can't get in the machine. What about your unfinished business? She's like, I have no unfinished business. And then
she just
disappears.
That's also awesome. A universe where those kind of rules can be fooled by someone just saying it.
But here's the problem. If Casper's father died with unfinished business, which he did, of proving that the machine worked, why isn't his ghost there? And then Casper doing his good deed and like proving his father's machine worked and all this stuff, like his prize is getting to be a real boy to dance with the lady, but then he still has to be a ghost who lives in the house. Like, what kind of unfinished business does an 8-year-old child have that has him like condemned to be a ghost forever in this house with three fully adult ghosts who basically, I guess in our other through line, function kind of like mobsters? Like, they like disappear to go like bet on the ponies and like get drunk. It's like, I don't really understand what Casper's unfinished business is. And by the end of the movie, has he still not resolved his unfinished business? Because he's still a ghost. Like, I feel like if they were making it today, they probably would still do the beat where Casper gets to be a real boy to dance with her, and it's to say goodbye because he's moving on.
Yeah.
But I think they kind of wanted to leave it open to, like, maybe we'll do more Casper movies.
And apparently,
if you can't have Casper move on, then there's no Casper.
Apparently, they did do some other stuff in that continuity. I think, like, a cartoon or something.
They did cartoons. Yeah. So it's sort of, that part doesn't make any sense. I also, my memories of the movie clearly have gaps. From being a child, because I remember her moving to the house. I remember her being friends with Casper, and everybody remembers the dance. I thought I remembered her like going to school, which she only does once in the movie, just once, goes to school, and that's it, and has the class over for a party. But like, it's like they couldn't decide on a plot, and so they just took a whole bunch and kind of sewed them together. I don't at all remember what ultimately is like the crux of the climax of the movie, which is her father gets drunk with the ghostly trio and falls down an open manhole cover and dies.
I was shocked at that part.
They gotta use the only like juice left for the machine that brings the dead back to life by shoving her father's ghost in there and turning it on and letting Bill Pullman stumble out.
That, by the way, I mentioned that of like how this would change that universe. This is another one of my big overall movie things. Not necessarily something I like, but something I'm always fascinated by, which is movies that tell a story in which very often it's being told in what feels like the present day real world. Most of the time, present day real world. And yet at the end of the story, despite the fact that the movie has generally had a certain level of what seems like verisimilitude or reality to the present day, the end of the movie makes it clear that in any sane version of that world would now have to be fundamentally altered forever by the revelation of something that the end of the movie kind of acts as if it's just going to walk away from now and say goodbye to the viewer. But wait a minute.
They do a song and dance number.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And like in this case, I wish I could think of other examples right now, but because there are a lot of them where you feel like you can't walk away from the movie the way it's ending, because how can you possibly not tell us now what happens to this world that now knows, for instance, that zombies exist or that the... That's just a random thing. I can't think of a specific movie. But in Casper specifically, it's that whole idea that he's a scientist, kind of. And I mean, surely the media is going to get a hold of some of this stuff. And shouldn't people now find out that there is now definitely an afterlife and ghosts and... Although the thing is, if it's the Ghostbusters universe, they kind of already know, don't they?
But they kind of forget in the Ghostbusters universe.
Yeah, all the time.
But the thing here, too, is that a lot of people have seen the ghosts in Casper.
Yeah.
They bring in like half a dozen crews to try to do construction on the house, all of whom leave because there are ghosts in it. And not only that, but unlike basically every other ghost movie that has ever existed, the ghosts are not tethered to a place. Like, typically, in a ghost movie, ghosts are stuck in the place they're in and they can't move on, but they can't go away. And that's why the whole idea of like haunted houses is the ghosts live in the house.
We even said there's like a friendlier version of the Crimson Peak house.
Yeah, a little bit. But the thing is, they can totally leave. Casper goes to school with her and ties everyone's shoelaces together. The ghostly trio like go to the racetrack. They go to a bar where everyone sees them and freaks out and leaves. And like, so they can go places and do things. Why do they keep coming back to the house? Like, do you have to recharge your batteries or something? Like, yeah. I don't know. But they can go anywhere they want and they can fly. And like, they even have that, the bit where like Casper takes Christina Ricci flying, where he can like hold her and like takes her up in the air.
I totally forgot they kind of have like a Superman Can You Read My Mind moment too. It's a very romantic movie.
It is.
And that's one of the things that disturbed me.
Children.
Yeah, very.
But also there's a reason, I guess, it kind of made a romantic impact on people who were my age, who were basically teens and preteens when this movie came out. And Christina Ricci was such a big deal. Devon Sawa was such a big deal. Devon Sawa's barely in the movie. He's not even doing the voice of Casper. Like, if it was his voice the whole time, maybe you could argue. It's like, but he is barely in it. So it's, I don't know. I would still sit down and watch it again, like, today. Like, I still have a love for it. But I definitely don't think it's a coherent movie. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And it just kind of jumps from scene to scene, like almost beat for beat, as if you're expecting the screen to go dark and fade back in again, like it's a commercial break in a sitcom. Like, that's how segmented it is. So, yeah, totally, it's off. It doesn't know what it is. But also, I mean, you play that little Can I Keep You bit with Devon Sawa at the dance, and like every woman between the age of 35 and 45 currently will go, oh.
Thanks for listening to Ghouls in the House, featuring Natalie Bielatowski and Arnold T. Blumberg. You can find Natalie on Threads at Positively Natalie and me at Doctor the Dead. Our movies this episode were Abigail, 2024, The Boy, 2016, and Casper, 1995.
What's so funny?
Ghouls in the House is an ATB Publishing production. Check out our other podcasts, books on your favorite fictional worlds, and other assorted goodies at www.atbpublishing.com.
Then you can handle this.
It's no problem. It's like no problem whatsoever. Piece of cake, piece of crumb cake.